We're continuing our series this morning, looking at various conversations with God, thinking about what does it mean to be a praying people. And one of the reflections that I think I've certainly had, and I imagine you may kind of concur with me, is when many people think about prayer, I think one of the first things they think about is, well, that wish list. Because prayer is about asking God for things. Maybe our wants, our desires, so on and so forth. As we're going to be reminded in today's passage, though, that's not the case. And actually, it isn't always as straightforward as that either, even if I think we might sometimes wish it was. I'm going to read from 1 Samuel and verse chapter 1, starting at verse 1. If you've got a Bible, I encourage you to open it, turn it on. As we read, as Jenny said, the beginning of the first book of Samuel. There was a certain man from Mount Ramathaim, a Zophite from the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zoph, an Ephraimite. He had two wives, who were called Hannah and the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had none. Year after year, this man went up from his town to worship and sacrifice to the Lord Almighty in Shiloh, where Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord. Whenever the day came for Elkanah to sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to his wife Peninnah and also his sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion because he loved her, and the Lord had closed her womb. Because the Lord had closed Hannah's womb, her rival kept provoking her in order to irate her. This went on year after year. Whenever Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, her rival provoked her until she wept and would not eat. Her husband, Elkanah, would say to her, "Hannah, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why are you downhearted? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons? Once when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on his chair by the doorpost of the Lord's house. In her deep anguish, Hannah prayed to the Lord, weeping bitterly. She made a vow, saying, "Lord Almighty, if you will only look on your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head." She kept on praying to the Lord. Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying in her heart, and her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk, and said to her, "How long are you going to stay drunk? Put away your wine." "Not so, my Lord," Hannah replied. "I am a woman who is deeply troubled. I have not been drinking wine or beer. I was pouring out my soul to the Lord. Do not take your servant for a wicked woman. I've been praying here out of my great anguish and grief." Eli answered, "Go in peace. May the Lord of Israel grant you what you have asked of him." She said, "May your servant find favor in your eyes." Then she went her way and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. Early the next morning they arose and worshipped before the Lord, and then went back to their home at Ramah. Elkanah made love to his wife Hannah, and the Lord remembered her. So in the course of time, Hannah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, saying, "Because I asked the Lord for him." When her husband Elkanah went up with his family to offer the annual sacrifice to the Lord to fulfill his vow, Hannah did not go. She said to her husband, "After the boy is weaned, I will take him and present him before the Lord, and he will live there always." "Do what seems best to you," her husband Elkanah told her. "Stay here until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord make good his word." So the woman stayed at home and nursed her son until she had weaned him. After he was weaned, she took the boy with her, young as he was, along with a 3-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, and a skin of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. When the bull had been sacrificed, they brought the boy to Eli, and she said to him, "Pardon me, my Lord, as surely as you live, I am the woman who stood here beside you praying to the Lord. I prayed for this child, and the Lord has granted me what I asked of him. So now I give him to the Lord. For his whole life he will be given over to the Lord." And he worshipped the Lord there. In the Hebrew text, 1 Samuel actually follows the book of Judges, Ruth being among a number of writings that are in the third division of the Hebrew scriptures. And I mention that because if you were to flick back to the very end of Judges, in chapter 21, verse 25, it says, "In those days Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit." Israel had no king, but something was coming. A new era was on the horizon. And so the backdrop to this passage is Israel waiting for a king. Yet, however much we might know that's where it's heading, if we're familiar with the ongoing story of God's people, there's no rush, it seems, to get there. Walter Brueggemann points out that at this point, actually, Israel, in their history, were seen as something of a marginal community due to primarily the power and the pressure of the Philistines, who we generally come to know through chapter 17 and Goliath, kind of the boy who did listen to his parents saying, eat your veg when you're told to. But we know something actually of the ongoing story as well. This is a story that's primarily going to be unfolded through three men. It's a story that's going to be about Samuel, it's going to go on to Saul, and thirdly, through to David. Yet behind these three great men, powerful men, who did many wonderful things, there is a significant story about a barren woman. And the narrative, if you read through, doesn't downplay or hide the heart of what's going on here, of what Hannah was going through, the reality of her situation. Now, barrenness in the Bible does not mean the same thing as infertility today. And I think it's important that we just kind of focus on that for a second, because otherwise it can be very easy to misunderstand things. While modern medicine has made it possible to recognize that infertility is a medical problem, back in biblical times, barrenness was seen as a curse, it was seen as a punishment, or a withholding from God. And therefore, the main remedy for it, as we see on a number of occasions, is prayer and divine intervention. And it's just that, I think, that helpful reminder to us that we mustn't take kind of the biblical context and place it into the world today, or vice versa. I'm very conscious that the whole area of infertility, of people not being able to have biological children, is something that is very painful. It's something that is very misunderstood often. It's something that often, sadly, very mishandled, and within the life of the church, not least in society. And so it requires a real sensitivity to it and a real careful pastoral approach. But I think it's just, again, that reminder that we need to read the Bible and really grasp what is being said here, what is going on, what was taking place, rather than kind of assuming things because of where we find ourselves today. Elkanah, he had a quite a powerful genealogy. We read a bit of it at the start of the chapter. But he's got this problem in that his wife is barren. And kind of Hannah, obviously up to this point, has not been able to give him the son that he would want, that he would hope for. And we're not told whether Peninnah kind of was taken as a second wife because of Hannah's barrenness, but there's potentially that reality in terms of how things may have taken place. Within this passage, though, we have a kind of a lovely narrative that goes from kind of beginning to end in terms of her story and obviously the birth of her son. Story begins, there's no child for her. There's no son. So there's no heir. There's no future. There's no historical possibility. They are going to be forgotten. She is going to be forgotten and just marked up somewhere along the way. But as the story concludes, it results in worship and a son is given and a future is opened up. And so as we're introduced to Elkanah, he has two wives. And obviously, monogamy was not standard practice back then. But part of me wants to go to him and say, kind of, Elkanah, you know, you're asking for trouble here, mate. I'm not going to make any more comments about wives and numbers and that's any at that point, because I know I'm just going to end up in a hole. But you kind of think his situation doesn't bode well, really. I don't know how Solomon got on with it. But as a family, they make this trip, obviously each year, part of their rhythm, part of what they do, not just kind of, shall we do it this time? No, no. This was something they did on a regular basis, year by year. They make this trip, and it's almost like a highlight of their year. They go to Shiloh for communal, for worship, for sacrifice, quite probably taking part in the Feast of Tabernacles. And it would have been kind of quite an occasion. It would have been something that would have been looked forward to. It would have been something that, a real celebration, an opportunity for the family year by year to go and to rejoice in God's blessings. And again, as an aside, we see here this picture of this godly, faithful living, this family who are committed to following the ways of the Lord, juxtaposed to Eli and his sons, the priests who Hannah is going to encounter within this particular trip. However much though it's a happy occasion, it would have been a celebration for Hannah. That's not the case. And Elkanah kind of grasps something of that. Verse 5 it says, but to Hannah he gave a double portion because he loved her and the Lord had closed her womb. But yet at the same time there's kind of, I think, a sense that he doesn't quite get it. He doesn't completely understand all that she's going through. His response in verse 8, you know, don't I mean more to you than 10 sons? She's obviously saying, well no. You know, obviously that relationship, that care, that love must have meant something. But ultimately there was still something missing in her life. And so we have this picture of, I mean, you want to visualize it, this meal, bring in the food, the sacrificial meat, and everyone's kind of tucking in, but there's one person who is, maybe that's playing with their food. Or maybe Hannah's just actually not even touching it. She can't even stomach the thought of it at all. Because her situation is just bringing her down. Talk about in verse 6 about Peninnah in terms of her rival. I just think even that word just says something really quite nasty and horrible about this situation. That for Hannah it's not just the reality that she can't have a child, but actually she's being taunted about it. By someone who she's going to see day in, day out. Not just by someone she's going to pass by once in a while, but no, every single day. She's visibly reminded by it, by Peninnah's children, but also by the taunts that she puts before her. So she leaves the gathering and she goes off and we're told she weeps. She prays to God, weeping bitterly. And whereas, if you were here last week when we reflected on Nehemiah's situation and he wept before God, he was weeping for the situation of God's people. He was weeping for those who were undergoing real trials and for their particular circumstances. Here, Hannah is crying out and she's weeping personally. She's weeping because all hope is lost. So she prays. Now, it's interesting, I don't know if you've ever been to a wedding, and there's something that happens that just changes the mood. I was talking with Ruth and Tony Rymal this week when I went to visit them, and they're sharing, Ruth was sharing that when they got married, she apparently just broke into fits of giggles and couldn't stop laughing. And however awkward we might think that is, actually I think in wedding services, that's really, really helpful. Something just to break the ice, to break the tension. For Emma and I think I've shared this before, it was a case that when Andy, who was marrying us, said, could you take your ring, Ed? So I did. I took my ring. What he actually obviously meant, he didn't say, was, can you take Emma's ring? Because this is the point where you're going to put that ring on her finger. She's then going to pick up your ring, and vice versa. But again, it broke the ice. It just made the moment lighter. And in part, I think that's really helpful because actually there's something quite serious when you get married. The actual words you say that are legally binding in terms of making you a married couple are very, very limited. There's actually very few words that you have to say. I remember when I was first given a book of the kind of the different kind of patterns and stuff for Baptist ministers. The minister who gave it to me, he'd retired. He'd underlined these, I think it's about 8 words. And they are the bits that the wife has to say to the husband and the husband has to say to the wife. The rest of it, legally, is all just padding. Now, obviously, for us, we believe that marriage is much more than just those legal few words. Actually, it's about making a commitment. It's about making a vow to one another. And it's with a similar sort of seriousness, really, that Hannah kind of says in verse 11, Lord Almighty, if you will only look on your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head. Give me a son, she says, and I will give him back to you. Hannah is bold enough to believe that God will not only hear her prayer, but actually answer it for a son. And we might kind of say, but the motives are a bit mixed here, really. It's interesting, though, it feeds in, obviously, to God's plan and his overarching purposes. And Hannah's not the first person, if you think back through the Old Testament, who has faced this kind of challenge. Sarai in Genesis 11, Rebecca in Genesis 25, Leah in Genesis 29. There's a number who have faced this question of going to God, unable to have children, seeking God's move on their lives. And so she cries out to him. She says, you know, if you give me this son, I will give him back to you. The cynic might say, oh, but you're going to say anything in that situation, surely. You know, everyone makes promises that are just to better their current situation. The reality is they're never going to hold up to them. And surely that's what Hannah's doing here. She was saying this to God, saying, you know, if you kind of, you know, sway the situation for me a bit, you know, help me out here, then kind of, obviously I'll do that for you. Knowing that that's further down the line, and really she won't have to worry about it. A prayer in verse 10 and 11, though, is followed up, verse 24, when we see that she brings the child back to the house of the Lord. It's not haphazard in any way. Shown also by the words she used when she says, you know, no razor will ever be used on his head. Talking about the Nazarite vow. You might think classically of Samson. But this idea of someone who is separate, who is consecrated, who has been given over completely to God and his purposes. Now in this moment, Eli, kind of obviously watching, sees what's going on and is quick to rebuke her. The fact that he sees her lips moving, no words coming out, and just jumps to the assumption, oh well, obviously she's drunk, she's been drinking too much, that sort of thing, has come out from the meal and is now in the house of the Lord, you know, unable to control herself. And we might kind of go, we wouldn't expect anything less from Eli, really, with where he kind of continues in terms of the passage and the things that he and his sons have got up to. Hannah, though, obviously kind of says, no, that's not the case. And he must realise instantly, you know, she doesn't stink probably of alcohol. She's able to coherently communicate. And there's obviously that sense in her eyes, probably, of the heartache that she is feeling, the pain that is on her lips. And we see this bittersweet moment where Eli realises and blesses her and kind of sends her on her way. May God, you know, give you what you ask for. And it's this moment, this glimmer of hope that's sadly too late for Eli. For all the wrong things that he does and for all the way that his family ends in destruction. Actually, there's this sense of there was something there. It's almost like, you know, the villains who redeem themselves at the end of movies, Darth Vader, you know, they doesn't get to live happily ever after. You know, Diego, Emperor Zurg, the T-800, you can pick a number of them, who in their moments, they kind of come to the fore and they finally do some good, but it's all too late. And so Eli blesses her and she returns, verse 20, before the year is out, she has a son, Samuel. And to some extent, kind of that's our tale. We could stop there, really. Kind of she prays, God answers, everyone's happy, let's go home. Except the conclusion of the chapter actually is quite a key and vital element to this story. Hannah stays at home until Samuel is 2 or 3, but it's not to backtrack on her vow, but waiting, and then she brings her son, as she promised, to present him towards the Lord. And there's this lovely moment. I like to picture her. You know, she comes, the sacrifice to be made, and she finds out, seeks out Eli. And she says, you know, do you remember me? And thinking back, obviously, a few years, you know, and suddenly that penny would have dropped that she was the woman who was weeping, who was kind of incontrollable, he thought was just off her face. And yet she's come through with her promise. She's brought her son back to the Lord. And there's a number of people look at this example of, you know, being real salt and light in the community. She's someone who really models what it means to be a follower of the Lord. Again, unlike Eli and his sons. And so there's various questions that might kind of be posed at this point to us. You might think, be sitting there thinking, okay, so is this passage, when we think about prayer, is this kind of the name it and claim it stuff that I might have heard of? Is it a case that actually I can ask God whatever I want and I'll get it? Because surely that's what happens with Hannah here. And no, that's not the case at all. Prayer is not some holy wish list. If it was, then we'd all be driving kind of, you know, fast modern cars. We'd live in 10 bedroom houses. We'd all have heated pools. I'd have an ice cream maker ready for me, you know, when I come home, and whatever it is and whatever it is for you. That was how it'd work. If prayer was just this abundant kind of genie, you rub the lamp 3 times and you get whatever you want. That's not how prayer works. And that means that sometimes we don't know why God doesn't answer some prayers. why we don't always get the things that maybe we are praying for very selflessly for others who are actually in real pain. Maybe even some of the names that we thought of today and we were praying. Actually, people, God, we really pray that you would move in their situation. For some reason, God hasn't yet. But I think it's also noting here in Hannah's prayer, in her vow, this was a big ask, but she was willing to give it away. This wasn't kind of, I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. No, she was willing to deliver on what she promised to God. And I imagine if we actually prayed a prayer like Hannah would, well, I'm not sure many of us could, to the level that she actually committed herself to the Lord's purposes. We might have that question, you know, is this all then about emotion? Is that what we're saying? You know, we heard last week about Nehemiah and he was weeping and stuff like that, and we've got it again now with Hannah. Is this a subtle bid, really, to try and put across a view that actually if we just make a bit more noise and that sort of thing when we're praying, maybe dance around a bit or whatever, that God will actually hear us? Is that what this is about? Again, I'm reminded of the classic example of Elijah and the prophets of Baal. You know, they're dancing around all day trying to whip up their God into some sort of frenzy. You know, Elijah just prays and the fire falls from heaven. And Hannah cries out to God, though. I think part of it is because there's this genuineness about her situation. And I wonder whether maybe sometimes we hold back when we're actually should let God have it all. We shouldn't think that God kind of, you know, can't cope, but actually be real with him. Is this maybe we think about persistence? Is that the question we've got? Actually, what this is about is to keep going, because obviously this would have been something that probably would have been a prayer that she would have prayed many, many times. And again, that doesn't equate to getting what we want. We might kind of quote Jesus, you know, when he teaches on being persistent in prayer. But again, it's asking that question, are we seeking after the will of God when we pray? And then asking that question, well, do I actually know the will of God? And I think it's reminding ourselves that we are not God. So however much we might seek to be in tune with him, we might seek to be aligned with him, we might seek to be doing everything we can, ultimately, we don't know what God's will is. And if anyone ever says that they're kind of above all else, they've got it, I don't believe they have. It's about us trusting God. It's about us being willing to live by faith and step out for him. I think the key thing for Hannah in this passage is the fact that she was real, she was honest, and she was open with God. She was how she was. She said it the way it was, the way things were, and she didn't do it for anyone else's benefit. She didn't realise Eli was there, I imagine. It wasn't something that she was grandstanding. No, she was having that conversation with God. And she was just laying it all out before him. Again, I wonder whether sometimes we think God can't take it. If I'm really telling him how I feel, if I really open up to him, and so I hold back. When the irony is that God already knows what we're feeling. But still, we think, oh, I can't actually put this before you because what might God think? I love the Message translation of the Bible. It begins Hannah's prayer, praying to, oh God of the angel armies. And it's again that reminder, she knows who she's praying to. And so she knows that she can lay everything out before him. There's nothing she's got to hold back. I guess my prayer out of this account is that God will break down some of the walls maybe that we've put up between us and him, or the mask that we've put on that stops us actually just going, God, this is where I find myself, help. The song by the band Third Day, and the chorus in it says this, it says, there is hope for the helpless, rest for the weary, and love for the broken heart. There is grace and forgiveness, mercy and healing. He'll meet you wherever you are. Cry out to Jesus. May Hannah's story encourage us to be a people of prayer. A people who cry out to God. Tell him how it is. Because we know he can handle it. Let's pray. Father God, I thank you that you are able to cope with anything that we set before you. Thank you, Lord, that you're able to cope with anything that we're going through. That doesn't mean that suddenly everything will be made better, we won't have to work through things, but you'll be with us in that moment and through it all. And this morning, Lord, if we're carrying things that maybe have become a burden that we don't know what to do with, pray that you will help us to offer them over to you. Help us to recognize that you are bigger than anything. We can cry out to you. We can tell you how it is. We can be real with you. And like a loving father, you will wrap us in your arms and go through whatever we're facing.